This is Science Friday. I'm Ira Flatow. The Los Angeles River has finally come to life, supercharged with rainwater. Freeways have flooded. And California's Sierra Nevada, the so-called Snowy Mountains, are once again living up to their name. But is this Godzilla El Nino, as my next guest calls it, raining down literally enough to put a dent in the drought out there? Or are residents of the West just so unaccustomed to seeing water and snowfall from the sky that they're getting their hopes up about what may turn out to be just average amounts of precipitation? Are you seeing the effects yourself? Give us a call, 844-724-8255, or tweet us at SciFry. Bill Patzert is a climatologist at NASA's Jet Propulsion Laboratory in Pasadena. Welcome to Science Friday.
Wow, this is a great pleasure.
Oh, the pleasure is all ours. Give us a scoop on El Nino. How big is it shaping up? And I understand from looking at the weather reports that you sort of have a train of storms coming in.
Well, this El Nino has been building for more than a year now, and this week it finally came to fruition here in California, where we did see a series of storms like a conveyor belt, and we had our first really good soaking in almost 5 years, and so there's a lot of excitement. It's been pretty sweet.
But you've been looking. I remember when I was out in California, that's all they talked about was, well, we're going to be saved this drought by the El Nino on the way.
Well, you know, not so quick. This is what I call the down payment on a drought with a huge mortgage to pay off. You know, big El Ninos only happen every 15 to 20 years. So when you look over the long haul, El Ninos only supply about 7% of our water supply. And so it'll take more than that to get us out of this punishing drought.
Weather forecasts out there looks pretty clear in the next few weeks. Do you expect more of these storms rolling on in?
Well, you know, January, February, and March in 1998, the last big El Nino,
yeah,
we had to wait till February, but when it arrived, it was spectacular. So everybody has to be a little patient here. This is a huge signal out there in the Pacific, and if it doesn't deliver record rainfall and snowpack, I'll definitely have to go into witness protection.
Well, how long do you expect it to last? Typically, how long does the El Nino let it rain out there?
Well, you know, El Nino, and let's not forget, has had a huge impact over the rest of the planet. Pretty spectacular. Here in California in the West, in the southern tier of the United States, it's January, February, March, and sometimes into April and May.
Yeah, because I've heard people explaining our mild winter on your El Nino.
Well, that's the El Nino, signal is the southern tier of the United States gets blasted with a series of storms from California to Florida, whereas the northern tier of the United States tends to be relatively mild and warmer. So the headlines are mudslides in Los Angeles and golfing in Minneapolis.
Yeah, they like that out there in Minneapolis. Just so you don't have to go alone by yourself into witness protection, I'm going to bring on another guest, a person who may have one of the most picturesque jobs in America. He flies over beautiful mountain ranges all over the American West using a laser to measure the snowpack that you're talking about. Tom Painter is a snow hydrologist at the Jet Propulsion Laboratory in Pasadena. Welcome to Science Friday.
Thanks for having me.
Tom, you're up in Lake Tahoe right now, right? What's it like up there?
Well, it's a spectacularly gorgeous California bluebird day, everybody up here is ecstatic with the amount of snow. And as you said in the intro, people's minds have gotten a little bit tweaked and into thinking that average conditions are the great messiah of snow for us now. And so it is wonderful seeing this amount of snow, but we do need to recognize that right now we're about spot on with average conditions for this time of year.
So then would you expect that you will have an average amount of water from the snowpack for next summer? There'll be adequate amounts like you would have in an average condition.
Well, if it keeps lumbering along like it is right now, then yeah, we would just end up with the average conditions. But Bill has promised that this El Nino is going to produce in a big time, just like 1998 and 1983. And I'll ship him off into the Witness Protection Program if it doesn't come to bear. We're pretty confident. Statistically, it should produce the big storms that we're hoping for, that will really make it leap up above average conditions. And back in 98 and in 95, here in the Sierra Nevada, the snowpack up in the higher elevations was continuing to grow at the beginning of June. Now, usually our peak is at around April 1st, but this conveyor belt of storms can continue on out through the spring, and you can see no let up at times when it's really determined to dump on the mountains.
How much could it potentially, if this conveyor belt continues, how much more snow? And how would it then really become something to talk about?
Well, these are the kind of storms that that change the face of the landscape. I mean, buildings get buried, large buildings get buried, and huge trenches have to be dug out for roads and for ski lifts. And in 1998, the campgrounds up in Upper Yosemite National Park never opened because of the amount of snow. It can be towering amounts of snow, and hugely beneficial for recharging the aquifers, getting the groundwater back toward where we need it. But as Bill said, this is a down payment. We've got a long ways to go. We need a lot of precipitation to bring us back, not only for the groundwater but also for the reservoirs. And the ecosystems themselves, we've lost an enormous amount of the forests in the Sierra Nevada simply because of this ongoing drought and the intensity of that drought.
Mm. Bill, could we expect it to hang around for another year, next year, come back and dump some more water and snow?
Well, that's a long shot. After the last El Nino, we whiplashed back into a condition which is known as La Nina, where the waters in the equatorial Pacific get very cool. And I'm very fond of calling La Nina the diva of drought. And so the thing we have to be careful with here is that a year from now, we might be doing this interview talking about drought.
I'm booking it right now. I'm not hoping that we'll talk about drought, but the opposite of the El Nino. But I guess people are enjoying it even as it rains too much and snows too much. They're happy to see it.
I certainly am. You know, I was out on my front porch the other morning drinking my coffee, and you know, it was fantastic. It was coming down an inch to a half an inch an hour, and it was pretty exciting and sweet.
Yeah. Well, Bill, if our water supply is shrinking and the population is growing, should we take a cue from folks who know about droughts, like in Israel and Australia, the vanguards of water conservation, and take a lesson or two from them? Is there anything we can learn from them?
You know, the population in California has quadrupled in the last half century. Agriculture has expanded, and a whole series of new industries have developed. So people forget that half of this drought is too many people using too much water in a semi-arid environment. And so, but the good news is we've developed a lot of conservation habits here during this drought, and people should not forget that is not temporary. That is a new lifestyle, or we'll be talking about drought forever.
Hmm. Yeah, well, at least for this year, the Sierra Nevadas, the so-called snowy mountains, are at least this year living up to their name.
Yeah, I've been concerned that Painter will be out of business, you know. but it looks like, you know, he's still on his feet and having a good time there at Lake Tahoe.
Bill, what's it like, Bill, to go up in a plane and zap the mountains with Tom with a laser beam and see all that stuff?
It's really amazing, and it was much of the reason that I moved to the Jet Propulsion Laboratory so we could do this for our community. We've long wanted to know how much total water there was up in the mountain snowpacks, but we've been using pretty much the same. We as a community have been pretty much using the same technology that was developed 100 years ago, just at the north end of Lake Tahoe here, by a professor from the University of Nevada, Reno, and in large part because traveling in the mountains is so it's hard, it's dangerous from the altitude and from avalanches. And we discovered a few years ago that we could put together a combination of technologies that have been used on Earth as well as in the solar system to map all across the mountain basins and add up actually how much water there is. So no longer do we need to say, oh, there's 110% of plus or minus 20-30%. We can actually say how much water is in the mountain snowpack, which is really what water managers want to know and what the critical number is. So this has been a breakthrough, and we were fortunate to be at the right time with the right motivation to get this going. And it certainly, the drought helped highlight this, and we're really hoping to have a massive El Nino so that we can measure gobs of snow.
We have a bird's eye view of Tom's airborne snow survey. You can fly over to sciencefriday.com/snowpack to see it. Gentlemen, thank you very much for taking time to be with us today.
Thanks for having us.
It's been an honor. I'm a big fan.
Well, say hello to Jay Familiati for us when you see him. Give us our regards. Have a happy new year. We'll be right back after this break. This is Science Friday. I'm Ira Flatow. I am one of those people who made a New Year's resolution to change my diet. Not just to go on a diet, but to change what I eat and the way I eat. And I went looking through diet books, and believe me, we get a ton of diet books here in our office. And there's lots of books by Michael Pollan. Remember his mantra? Eat food, not too much, mostly plants. Good advice. But what enticed me about my next guest's advice was the title of his book, Always Hungry. It spoke to me. Yes, always hungry. As I read the book, it explained why, and the problem boiled down to my fat cells. You see, fat's not just some gloopy, inert blob you're trying to get rid of. It's alive and releases and responds to chemical signals in the body. It's even looped in with your immune system and can cause inflammation if you don't treat it right. And this diet does not count calories. Yay, it lets you eat as much as you want once you've retrained your fat cells. Dr. David Ludwig is author of Always Hungry. He's a practicing endocrinologist at Boston's Children's Hospital, professor of nutrition at the famed Harvard School of Public Health. Welcome back to the program, Dr. Ludwig.
Thank you, Ira. Great to be with you again.
We have an excerpt of your book at sciencefriday.com/alwayshungry. David, Always Hungry, what was the catalyst for calling it that?
Well, you know, what is the most difficult problem that arises on a diet? People get hungry. And according to the conventional model, we're supposed to ignore the hunger, use discipline, and stick to the diet. And if you just do that, it's really so simple. If you just do that, eat a little less, move a little more, you'll be able to manage any kind of weight problem over time. And because it sounds so simple, people who can't do it, which are 90% of the country or more with a weight issue, people who can't do it are blamed for the problem. It must be at the very least poor willpower or discipline or possibly a character issue. You know, of course, in our society, we stigmatize people for this particular medical issue in ways that we don't for virtually any other.
Mm-hmm. You know, the real star of your book, the lead protagonist, may be the fat cell. Tell us why we We have such mythology about being fat in the fat cell.
Okay, well, the basic premise of the book is simple, although provocative. Overeating doesn't make you fat. The process of getting fat makes you overeat. Now, that sounds provocative, but it's actually based on decades, if not a century, of research to say that body weight is really much more about our biology than our willpower behavior. So something has triggered our fat cells to suck in and hoard too many calories. The fat cells are in communication with the bloodstream, and they actively can either take in or release calories. But if fat cells are driven into a feeding frenzy, in effect, they hoard too many calories, they hold on to them, the calories can check in, they can't get out, and there are too few in the bloodstream. So the brain recognizes that as a metabolic crisis. It doesn't see that there's too many calories in the fat cells. It's really a distribution problem. It's not in the right place in the bloodstream and available to fuel the needs of the body. So the brain does what it's supposed to do, what it's evolved to do, which is it makes us hungry and it slows down metabolism, making us more and more efficient. Cutting back on calories only makes the situation worse, creating a battle between mind and metabolism that we're destined to lose. So the solution is to think about weight issues like we do about any other problem controlling a basic body system, that there's something biologically wrong. How did it happen, and what can we do about it?
So you have to retrain the body and the fat cells in it to release
right.
the energy that's stored up and get rid of those fat cells.
So the issue is, we argue that the low-fat diet, not necessarily every low-fat diet, but the low-fat diet we've been eating in the United States for the last 40 years, which was loaded with processed carbohydrates, right? I mean, think of, up until very recently, we were told that a healthy breakfast might be a bagel, fat-free cream cheese, and a glass of juice. Now, these foods, these highly processed carbohydrates, raise blood sugar more than whatever happened throughout human evolution eating natural, less processed foods. The problem with that is it causes a massive outpouring of the hormone insulin. I call insulin the miracle grow for your fat cells, but it's not the kind of miracle you want. So think of what happens in type 1 diabetes. That's juvenile onset diabetes. Children come in without enough insulin, and they're invariably going to be suffering weight loss. They might be eating 5,000, 7,000, 10,000 calories a day. They'll still be losing weight. Without insulin, you can't gain weight. Now, if you treat them with insulin, they'll get back to their normal weight. If you overtreat them, they'll inevitably gain too much weight. So the premise of the book is that the highly processed carbohydrates we've been eating and a few other dietary and lifestyle influences has caused hormonal changes in the body, especially involving insulin, that drive fat cells into a feeding frenzy. So they feast, the rest of the body starves. We think of obesity as a state of excess, but it's really an issue of starvation to the body, and cutting back on calories makes that worse. So instead, we propose a much higher fat diet. We have a three-phase program and some other dietary changes and some lifestyle supports that also help the fat cells calm down. When that happens, the calories flood back into the body. You feel much more energetic. Cravings decrease. Energy expenditure increases. And you start losing weight with your body's cooperation, not against it.
Mm-hmm. I found it to be have elements of the Atkins diet in it.
Well, this does involve the same principles as very low carbohydrate or ketogenic diets, but this is not that. The phase one has we eliminate grains, potatoes, and added sugar for just 2 weeks. Phase two, we add back whole kernel and processed grains, and then in phase three, you get to start adding some of the more processed carbohydrates, but based on your body's ability to handle it. We know people differ in how they manage that. And let me give you an example of what, a metaphor for the conventional approach. So we tell people just eat less and they get hungrier and their metabolism slows down. We've known that for years. It's like treating, it's like considering fever a problem with heat in, heat out. You know, we hear the whole calorie in, calorie out. Imagine somebody said, you know, fever, we don't know what's really causing it, but it's just simply heat in, heat out. So we've just got to remove heat from the body. Take an ice bath. You know, so imagine how you would feel if you had a fever and you got into an ice bath. First of all, you probably wouldn't do it. If you did, of course your body temperature would drop, but your body would fight back with severe shivering, blood vessel constriction, and you'd feel miserable. That's, in a sense, what's happening with our treatment of obesity. It's missing its symptomatic treatment, and it's causing the body to fight back harder and harder, as well it should, if the basic problem is there aren't enough calories in the bloodstream. So this approach targets the source of the problem, which is fat cells on calorie storage overdrive. Once they calm down and stop storing too many calories, weight loss occurs without struggle.
Do you think that you could cure some people's type 2 diabetes on this diet?
Well, we know that type 2 diabetes in its early stages is fully reversible. It happens in the majority of people who undergo bariatric surgery. And I think in principle, there's no reason the diet can't do the same. And, you know, we used to call type 2 diabetes carbohydrate intolerance, you know, and yet the standard treatment for type 2 diabetes for the last 50 years has been a high carbohydrate diet. You know, somebody with lactose intolerance is told not to eat things with lactose. Why do we give so much carbohydrate to people with carbohydrate intolerance?
But you don't do away with all carbohydrates. You try to find, and you actually create recipes in your book for
using. That's right. For, you know, there may be, and this is an exciting area of research, you know, to the extreme low carbohydrate is called the ketogenic diet. And with essentially no carbohydrate, the body shifts into a different mode. In fact, the brain becomes adapted not to using much glucose at all, and it can live on ketones. Some people are claiming ketones are a sort of super fuel that the brain loves. It actually can be effective at preventing seizures in children. Some people are talking about it as anti-inflammatory and even anti-aging. But that's a very extreme diet. You can't even have much of any fruit, let alone grain products or starchy vegetables or the like. I think for most people, most people can do perfectly well as long as we target the highly processed carbohydrates. In other words, you can get most of the same effects, but with a much more easily adaptable diet that doesn't require elimination of any major nutrient at all.
What about fiber? You know, we keep hearing that our microbiome lives on fiber. Is that key in your diet?
Yeah, we like fiber. And this is, even though that we certainly have options for meat eaters, there are, I think this is a, there's a lot of plant foods, whole plant foods, which provide fiber, which serves as a fertilizer for our internal garden, the gut microbiome. So fiber is a key part of it. That's called prebiotics. Probiotics are the good bacteria that you get in yogurt or naturally fermented foods. And then polyphenols are sort of like weed killers. Polyphenols are the chemicals in plants that typically have color and oftentimes flavor, things like turmeric, the herb, the spice. And these polyphenols tend to target the harmful bacteria while leaving the helpful bacteria alone. So prebiotics, probiotics, and polyphenols are a way to grow a healthy internal gut flora, which is, mm-hmm. we now are discovering, really key to health and weight maintenance and chronic disease prevention.
You know, what I found also interesting in your book is that you make no distinction in artificial sweeteners and regular sugar. And I know they're different, and you talk about that. But you say that the body may not know the difference and may get just the taste of sweetness, even in an artificial sweetener, may trigger your body to act as if it's sugar. And that's a bad thing.
Yeah. Let me just fine-tune that message just slightly. I think that the research, and we've done, my research partner, Kara Ebling, and I, and our group at in Boston, have done a number of studies looking at sugary beverages versus non-caloric beverages on body weight in children to young adults in it. And it does seem from our research and others that if you have a weight problem and you get off of sugar onto diet beverages, diet artificial sweeteners, your body weight will improve. But that leaves the big question open. How do these artificial sweeteners compare to natural beverages, unsweetened beverages or mineral waters and the like? And we don't know, but there's reason for concern. So because they bind the sugar, the sweetness receptor, but that's in the mouth, but also throughout the digestive tract and even on fat cells. Fat cells have sweetness taste receptors. They can bind them and cause metabolic changes that signal the brain and signal the fat cells in possibly harmful ways. So we've got some interesting research studies pending, but I think for the moment, the safest approach is to think of these artificial sweeteners as at most a transitional tool to get you mm-hmm. off of the highly sugared stuff.
In your book, it also talks about your body, your fat cells being linked to the immune system. How does that happen?
Absolutely. Well, let's put on the perspective of being a bacteria. You know, fat cells, the fat tissue in our body is the most prized source of nutrition for invading microbes. They would love to go to town on our fat tissue. But why is fat so rarely infected? It's because it's under constant surveillance from the immune system. White blood cells are continuously traveling through fat cells looking for any possible invading microbe. And in fact, the fat cells themselves and the white blood cells send messages to each other. What happens when in obesity with insulin resistance is that the fat cells start to overgrow their blood supply. Some of them may actually suffer dysfunction or even die. They start releasing warning chemicals, more white blood cells rush in, and it creates inflammation. But in this case, there's no bacteria to kill. That inflammation becomes chronic. Fat tissue then starts secreting into the rest of the body these toxic inflammatory substances. When that inflammation spreads to the lining of the blood vessels, it can contribute to atherosclerosis and heart attack. Mm. When it goes to the pancreas, it can contribute to diabetes. If it goes to the brain, neurodegenerative diseases. You know, we're now seeing an epidemic of Alzheimer's, which some people are now calling type 3 diabetes.
Wow. I'm Myra Flato. This is Science Friday from PRI, Public Radio International. Talking with Dr. David Ludwig, author of Always Hungry. You know, I'm actually going to try this book out.
Good.
Because I want to, you know, it has recipes for it inside. It has, you really have to be diligent, it looks like, because there are charts and graphs. And you not only talk about food, but you talk about your mind and having to get sort of into a mindfulness state on some, to some degree.
Yeah, let me just say, you know, in terms of how difficult, yes, we do have to, we do have to make changes. And the first thing that we suggest we walk the reader through this is the home clean out. You know, it's a good time for a year for the home clean out.
Yeah.
To get rid of the unhealthful. There's so many toxic influences around us in society. At least we can create the home as a, you know, as a bastion of protection, a little sacrosanct area where when we're eating there, we're moving in the right direction.
Right.
But because this doesn't restrict any major nutrient, it's inherently easier to follow. And I'll have to give credit to my wife, who is a gourmet natural foods chef and educator. She oversaw all of the recipes and meal plans, and she's a busy working mother. And so we made it a point that all of the dinners can be made, essentially all of the dinners can be made in 30 minutes or less, lunches in 20 minutes or less, although you prepare a bit on the weekend. So you roast. Yeah. This is a rich, high-fat diet full of nuts, nut butters, full fat dairy, avocado, dark chocolate.
Well, we're going to try it out. Dr. David Ludwig, author of the new book, Always Hungry, professor of nutrition at Harvard School of Public Health. Thank you for joining us today.
Great to talk to you.
We have an excerpt at sciencefriday.com/always hungry. We'll be right back after this break. This is Science Friday. I'm Ira Flato. The early part of winter here in New York has been welcomingly mild. Almost spring-like on some days. And throughout December, you could have taken a walk in Central Park and have spotted red roses still in bloom, dandelion blossoms dotting the lawns? Well, this week reality returned. We got a little bit of real winter, as it is, as other parts of the country know, and they're under the snow. We're getting some winter now, so it's bye-bye begonias for now. But the cold weather doesn't mean you need to drop your spade and abandon your plants. We're going to give you some way to exercise your green thumb all during the winter. There's still a lot of puttering you can do, like pruning back the roses, properly storing those bulbs you dug up. I have my own little mini experiment. Well, maybe we'll talk about with those bulbs. And finding the right potting soil. You know, this is interesting. Not all potting soil is created equal and not all alike. And we're going to actually give you a recipe for making your own potting soil. So if you're trying to troubleshoot your winter garden and plants, or you want some advice, give us a call, 844-724-8255, or tweet us at SciFry, SCIFRI. Elizabeth Murphy is a soil scientist, author of Building Soil, a top-down to earth approach. She's based out in Ashland, Oregon. Welcome to Science Friday.
Hi, thanks for having me.
You're welcome. Gerard Lordahl is the director of open space greening for Grow NYC. He joins us here in NYC.
Nice to be here, Ira.
Welcome to Science Friday. Jerry, what are the basics of what we should be doing to keep our outdoor garden right now?
Well, in the wintertime right now, I mean, people are protecting the plants that might be a little susceptible to winter damage. And when we're talking about soil, you want to protect the soil. Now that we have a frozen surface of soil, mulching is really important. And lots of our community gardeners are composting. And these are all things that can be done now, protecting your plants through the winter, giving as much water to them as possible on those mild days. And then mulching are the two key things.
Because they're still growing. They need that water over the winter.
Right. Well, the surface of the soil is freezing with these freezing temperatures. And that freezing and thawing is what causes plant root damage. So I can't encourage your listeners enough to mulch as much as possible now that that surface is frozen. The problem is when it's not frozen, rodents can live under that layer of mulch. So now that the soil's frozen, it's okay.
Yeah, I noticed my camellias, they do terrible during the winter because they're not getting the water. It's frozen. Get out there and water them.
So those days when it is mild, above freezing, you can go out there and try to water as much as possible. You mentioned pruning, anything that needs to be protected. Those of you who have fig trees, cutting back the roses, these are things that need to be protected with burlap or straw or mulch.
Elizabeth, I know that January is sort of like start to grow your indoor seeds month or get the bulbs going in those daffodils and things.
That's right, yeah.
How do we make, I know I want to talk about making your own potting soil. How do you do that? Because what is soil? I mean, what's the difference between soil and dirt?
That's a very good question. And some people would even argue that potting soil isn't really soil because it's not in the ground. Soil really is this living ecosystem that's connected through all the microbes and fungi. So we have a lot of challenges when we're making a soil to use above ground, like in a potting mix or in our potted plants. And a lot of those challenges are that we still are able to provide the air, the water, and the nutrients for growing plants, even in these artificial environments. Mm-hmm. So when we're talking about starting seeds, we really want to make a potting mix that has really good drainage, and that's something that's essential. We need to use either sand or vermiculite to get that drainage. And we want to use material that holds a lot of water and releases some nutrients.
Mm-hmm. And we have actually some recipes for that up on our website at sciencefriday.com/potting soil. One recipe doesn't contain soil at all, I understand.
That's right.
What's
in
it?
A lot of propagation. Yeah, for starting seeds, the more popular mixes don't actually contain live soil at all because real soil is actually quite heavy, and we want a light porous material for starting those new seeds.
Mm-hmm. Can I scoop up all that soil I dug up outside during the winter and stick it in? Jerry is he's going crazy.
And Elizabeth knows that in her book. I mean, she mentions in her book talking about cooking soil, and many community gardeners and backyard gardeners will buy or make their own sterilized soil. The problem is there's a disease called damping off that could affect young seeds, and it could kill the seeds, and it could be frustrating for gardeners who are trying to start seeds if they're not using sterilized soil, as Elizabeth knows. So cooking your soil in an oven at 200 degrees for 20 minutes is a good thing, or use sterilized soil so you don't get these diseases attacking your seeds.
Mm-hmm. That's right. Yeah, you can buy that kind of soil too at garden centers.
Now I know that a lot of potting soils contain peat. It must be. Is it dug up literally from peat bogs, and is that a bad thing?
Yeah, that's right, and that's one of the things that I like to educate people about, because a lot of our horticultural industry is based on mining peat, and we are mining it. It's not necessarily a sustainable practice, and peat bogs are really important for carbon sequestration globally. In various places, they are mined at unsustainable rates. So actually, in England, there's a government mandate to move away from peat in horticultural industries by 2020. So there's lots of other alternatives that we can use, and this is one of the benefits of making our homegrown potting mixes. The purpose of peat is to hold on to moisture, and to release that to plants, and also to make your substrate nice and fluffy. But we can use things like coconut coir, which is a byproduct of the coconut fiber industry. Mm-hmm. Compost fulfills some similar functions. Sometimes it's a little heavy. Or we could use even ground-up newspaper in small quantities can replace the function of peat. So we have more sustainable alternatives.
Right.
And here in New York City, we have over 500 community gardens that compost. And at our green markets at Grow NYC, we're one of the largest networks of green markets. New York City residents can bring their kitchen food waste. So if you just made a pot of soup and you have the carrot tops and the right. onion peels, you could collect all that and bring it to over 50 of our green markets citywide. And then we have 7 partner organizations that convert that into compost. And as Elizabeth mentioned, that could be used in place of peat moss.
All right, I'm going to ask you a botanical question.
I'm ready.
Something that I've worried about, well, you know, as a gardener, I'm an avid gardener, and I think about this, and I look at different kinds of fertilizers and stuff, and I know what the numbers on the fertilizer mean. But when I go back to my biology 101 class, and I look under photosynthesis, and the formula for photosynthesis is?
C6H12O6.
Yes.
That's the result. Glucose, right?
Yeah. Well, the thing is, to create that, you have oxygen and carbon dioxide in the presence of sunlight creates that carbohydrate.
Mm-hmm.
Where is fertilizer mentioned in that formula anywhere? There's no fertilizer. I mean, where does the nitrogen fit in and all that kind of stuff? Maybe. You don't need it. It doesn't seem like you need it anywhere.
Well, on the cellular level, I'm sure Elizabeth can answer this question a little better. But in order for the processes of plants to function properly, they need the macro and micronutrients, the nitrogen, the potassium, the phosphorus, the copper. And those are on a cellular level, as I understand it, having chemical interactions to undergo the processes of respiration and photosynthesis that are necessary, and also to produce that fruit that we love, that tomato.
Right.
If we don't have those nutrients, we won't get those kinds of things.
I like
that
to get
answers
in,
your question.
No. I like to get into the weeds.
We need the scientists. So.
Elizabeth, do you know what what is going on there?
You know, most of our tissues are carbon-based, but take our muscles in our bodies, for instance. There's a lot of nitrogen that form the amino acids that form the muscles. So it's the same with plants. To form a lot of the tissues, nitrogen's really important. It's basically responsible for plant growth. Take phosphorus, for instance, which is NPK, our second nutrient in those fertilizer mixes. And think about ATP, right? The energy of the body. So phosphorus goes into making that ATP. Take potassium, for instance. It's a salt. And so as a salt, it's responsible for stomatal regulation, so opening and closing the stoma of plants that allow that carbon dioxide in, that allow photosynthesis to occur. So if we think about, you know, this holistic functioning of the body, of our bodies, of the plant body, there's a lot of complicated stuff that requires a lot of these different nutrients, these different chemicals, these different elements.
One of the things
it's kind of exciting.
It's interesting. I think that explains it. One of the things that I've been doing over the last few weeks before the ground is frozen is to pull up my dahlia bulbs and things like that. And always, I'm actually conducting my own experiment that I don't expect to work very well. But being the kind of guy I like to try things out, they always tell you to take the tubers out of the ground and put them in sawdust or paper or something like that. And put them in a cool spot, mm-hmm. right, for
cool,
the winter.
Cool, dry, and dark. That's correct.
Right. Now I know why, and then somebody explained to me, that's why your onions are sprouting in the refrigerator. It's cool, dry, and dark in there, right? Same with the garlic. Do I have to take it out of the soil if I have it in a pot? Can I just bring the whole pot and leave it in the garage? Or do I have to take it out of the soil?
My experience is that the soil tends to retain moisture. So that's why they want you to take it out and put it in something that is not going to retain the moisture, like sawdust or dry peat moss, if you have it available. Right now, what's on probably your listeners' minds are those daffodil bulbs that they haven't planted. And can they put them in the ground, and will they have success?
Yeah.
Well, the window of opportunity was up until about Thanksgiving for daffodils, and that's because they need that cool temperature but not freezing to develop a root system that will enable them to get through the winter. Daffodils can last a little longer with that into Thanksgiving, tulips as well. So the refrigerator is a place where people could replicate that cold, chilling temperature without freezing. If you put your daffodils that you haven't had a chance to plant in the refrigerator in a brown paper bag, dark and dry, for about 6 weeks or so, you'll replicate that outdoor temperature, and you'll be able to force those daffodils indoors. You could then repot them.
They'll actually sprout. You'll see them.
Yes,
sprout.
I've had
indoors.
Success doing it myself. Or if it gets mild, you can try and put those daffodils out in the ground at this point, if we have a mild spell. But it seems like we're going towards the freezing temperatures these days.
Wow.
Yeah, and getting back to your question, can I just take the soil and put it inside, gets back to the question about, can I just use any old soil in my potting mixes? So there's a lot of different types of soils. So some soils are a lot heavier, have a lot of clays, and they're going to hold on to moisture more. If you have a really light sandy soil, you're more easily going to get away with just bringing your bulbs inside in that soil, because they won't stay wet through the winter as much.
I'm Ira Flatow. This is Science Friday from, excuse me, PRI, Public Radio International. Talking about gardening tips with with Gerard Lordahl and Elizabeth Murphy. So maybe I'll have some luck. I'm trying, maybe I'll have some luck, and being in the cool, they'll start sprouting up. If they were to start sprouting themselves, what month would I expect this? Start seeing.
Are you talking about your dahlias?
Yeah, well, I'm talking about,
It depends, you know, the different tubers and corms, like you have your gladiola corms, you have your dahlias, but the most successful are paperwhite narcissus that people mm-hmm. force indoors, or daffodils. But gardening is all about timing, and things plant, you know, flower and come into growth periods at different times of the year. You would never want to start your tomato seeds now.
Uh-oh.
You know, amaryllis bulbs need to go through a dormant period in order for them to bloom. So there's a lot of timing that's involved. And related to soil, a lot of listeners right now might be concerned in having their soil tested for correct pH. And that's a big thing we do with the community gardeners in the wintertime. Make sure they have the correct pH. And as many scientists and gardeners know, if your pH is correct, whatever nutrients are in the soil will be made more available for the plants to benefit from.
Mm-hmm. And if you have acid rain, it's going to make the soil acidic.
Well, yeah, you know, all those different elements can have an effect on the soil. You know, putting down lime increases the pH range of your soil.
Right.
Adding sulfur decreases it. Blueberries, if you're growing blueberries, they like an acid soil. So these are things to keep in mind. But here in New York City, where we have issues with our pH because we're surrounded by a lot of concrete, we encourage home gardeners and community gardeners to have their soil tested with simple pH test kits and then adjust it accordingly.
Elizabeth, any last words of advice for the wintertime?
Well, I agree that it's really important to check your nutrient balance in your soils, because we want to be successful as gardeners. And if you're missing something really important, it's going to be really disappointing. So getting that check is good. And a lot of that, too, is starting in the fall. So it's great that we're talking about soils in the winter, because we don't always think about them. And a lot of that work, the work for the spring, actually starts in the fall, because that's when the microbes in the soil wake up and they're ready to eat. So feeding them in the fall, especially through mulching like we've been talking about, is really important so that we can
got the whole micro, whole microbiome going on in the soil there. Thank you, Elizabeth. Elizabeth Murthy, soil scientist, author of Building Soil, A Down-to-Earth Approach, and Gerard Lordahl is director of open space greening for Grow NYC right here in New York. One last thing. Remember the news about the four new elements that fill in the line 7 of the periodic table? That's 1, 13, 15, 17, and 18. It's a triumph of chemistry, but better. And it's an excuse for us to play a little bit of Tom Lehrer's The Elements song, as sung by the Notre Dame Glee Club at the Live Science Friday show there. Enjoy.
There's antimony, arsenic, aluminum, selenium, and hydrogen, and oxygen, and nitrogen, and rhenium, and nickel, neodymium, neptunium, germanium, and iron, americium, ruthenium, uranium, europium, zirconium, lutetium, vanadium, and lanthium, and osmium, and astatine, and radium, and gold, protactinium, and indium, and gallium, and iodine, and thorium, and thulium, and thallium. There's yttrium, ytterbium, actinium, rubidium, and boron, gadolinium, niobium, iridium, and strontium, and silicon, and silver, and samarium, and bismuth, bromine, lithium, beryllium, and barium.
Strontium, and silicon, silver, and samarium, and bismuth, bromine, lithium, beryllium, and barium.
There's holmium, and helium, and hafnium, and erbium, and phosphorus, and francium, and fluorine, and terbium, and manganese, and mercury, molybdenum, magnesium, dysprosium, and scandium, and cerium, and cesium, lead, praseodymium, and platinum, plutonium, palladium, promethium, potassium, polonium, and tantalum, technetium, titanium, tellurium, and cadmium, and calcium, and chromium, and curium.
And cadmium, and calcium, and chromium, and curium.
There's sulfur, californium, and fermium, berkelium, and also mendelevium, einsteinium, nobelium, and argon, krypton, neon, radon, xenon, zinc, and rhodium, and chlorine, carbon, cobalt, copper, tungsten, tin, and sodium.
And argon, krypton, neon, radon, xenon, zinc, and rhodium, and chlorine, carbon, cobalt, copper, tungsten, tin, and sodium.
There may be many others, but they simply have no name. And let's hope that we'll discover more here at Notre Dame.
Ba-ba-la-la-ba-ba.
B.J. Lederman composed our theme music, and our thanks to our production partners at the studios of the City University of New York. And you want to know what happens when you send a styrofoam cup to the ocean floor? It shrinks. I mean, it's amazing. Explore the high pressure of the deep ocean with a series of at-home experiments, of course. We have them up there at sciencefriday.com/educate. It's a really interesting experiment. Have a great weekend. I'm Ira Flatow in New York.